There's some interesting research showing that empowering women boosts productivity and economic growth. A 2012 study by Booz & Company estimated that raising female employment to male levels could increase GDP by 10% in South Africa. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization found that by giving women equal access to resources like land and fertilizers, agricultural output in developing countries could increase by up to 4%. Placing women at the center of systems thinking unlocks more inclusive, sustainable, and equitable solutions that drive social and economic growth. And there are studies to back this up. To explore this further, we're joined by Dr. Nabulali Dangazele, faculty at the Gordon Institute of Business Science. Thank you, Dr. Dangazele, for your time. I mentioned some of the studies showing the potential impact from empowering women. Doesn't this suggest that we are depriving our institutions and businesses of opportunity by neglecting to examine our business models and policies, particularly from the perspective of women? And I guess that would result in more equitable solutions and at the same time reveal blind spots.
Certainly. I mean, whenever I think of economies, I think of them as an ecosystem. I love biomimicry within my strategy modules. And for me, it's like, would you exclude 50% of a specific species and think that you're going to survive? You know, the entire system underperforms when you exclude people that can be economically active, but also have, like you've shared in some of the studies, actually could outperform the other gender. So in South Africa, for me, we see, for example, stock falls move up to about 50 billion annually, specifically, you know, ones that are run by women. They're sustainable, they sustain families, they see children going to school and homes being built. So for me, it's like, from a formal banking perspective, women are really good. From a banking perspective, they're great customers. But also in the informal sector, they really do uphold the informal economy, whether it's running spaza shops, hair salons, and the like. So for me, I feel it's really a blind spot, you know, and it's not just in South Africa, because from my experience being doing a VC course recently here in the UK, I found that, you know, female entrepreneurs face barriers where only about 2% of VC funding goes to women here in the UK. And I feel that's a big blind spot. And just, you know, exclusion based on one's gender shouldn't be something that's still happening in 2025. Because like for like, women have proven themselves to sometimes outperform men, be it as prime minister, presidents, or even CEOs. So I feel like maybe it's an opportunity for us to stop treating the inclusion of women as a charity and not just the unfortunate way that a system is, but to actually imagine how trusting women and entrusting them with the responsibility of holding those executive roles, gaining access to funding, being financially included, having procurement policies that value, for example, unpaid care work as economic input can actually not just improve the livelihood of women, but like you've said to your point, potentially improve the GDP and have you know, incremental value to the GDP in an exponential manner just by taking notice of us as women and saying, hey, you're valuable to our economy.
It is interesting that the studies that I mentioned showing that by involving women more in the economy, you get better outcomes. And it seems that placing women at the center of these systems designs contributes to, in one aspect, innovation, but also productivity and ultimately GDP growth. Give us an idea how this is actually achieved in practice.
So I recently did some work commissioned by a multinational to look at how can we actually define financial inclusion, look at its benefits, create policies, dashboards, but also programs that can, you know, leverage certain resources within the entity, but also put women, youth, and persons with disabilities at the center of economic activity. And three ways in which we found from the research as well as engaging with the client was having diversified feedback channels. As we know, communication within organizations is important for building trust, ensuring that innovative engagements happen, you know, in an agile manner, but also businesses are able to grow and make sure that everybody is on the same page. So diversified feedback channels where women are enabled to not only hear messaging, be exposed to information, but also can also feedback and create a loop where from diversified perspective, they can also inform policies, but also give immediate feedback on things that are working to their benefits, but where there can also be improvement, because an agile approach to any form of system increases its viability, the possibility for it to succeed, because you're not waiting for the end result, but you're constantly using an iterative approach a la design thinking to make sure that what you do is fit for business, but also is future fit. So diversified feedback channels where multi-generations on different platforms, on different networks, but also in different ways can also enable for women to lead design. The second thing is resource fluidity. So there are examples of, you spoke about Food and Agriculture Organization, and I did some work with them on their antimicrobial resistance just after COVID. And what we found is that, like, women in Rwanda, for example, women co-ops were able to completely redesign an agriculture supply chain system, cutting cost post-harvest losses by 30%. Why? They diversified channels of feedback, were able to use information on the ground, pun intended, and then apply resource fluidity a la systems thinking to make sure that this agile approach to agriculture can actually see and yield exponential results in direct relationship to harvest lost. And not to say that men can't do that as well, but there was a way in which the collectivized manner in which the women approached things, saying that it's not each to their own, but together we can do more, as an ethos that enabled them to actually propel the work that they did because of how they were working as a system, not as just individuals. And then lastly, risk mitigation. As we know from a social perspective, you know, there are so many groups that are collectivized around women's activities. Umanyano, for example, in the Christian faith, enables women to gather at least once a week, you know, to talk about spirit-led things. But Umanyano has actually become a principle that has gone into the corporate space, where you find women mothers meeting on Thursdays and saying, what social ills, what social problems, what economic challenges can we actually mitigate, because we're aware of the risk, but also the opportunities that lay in there. So I believe that women's networks, like your Stockfalls, like your Manyanos, are some of South Africa's original social safety tech, preventing crises from becoming catastrophes. That's why, you know, your women's march was something that was possible, because women talk not just in the formal structures but informal as well, and their networks are far and wide. So to sum up that, I believe diversified feedback channels, resource fluidity, and risk mitigation through the networks that women actually create can be ways in which a woman-centered design can result in the growth of the economy.
Of course, we're not just talking about gender diversity here. There's also issues of race, class, age. There's a lot of silos within any organization. And I'm curious to find out from you how a woman-centered system would be able to arrive at a more inclusive transformation in an environment like that.
So here we're speaking about intersectionality. When you touch on race, one's ability, be it visible or invisible, disabilities, age, it means that there's not just one point of departure from which we're looking at the individuals, but the multiple manners in which one can face, you know, divergence, but also inclusivity. So this reminds me of a study that I did with UNDP during the time of COVID, where they were really looking at, do we actually discriminate against women, one, as a question, right? And then secondly, is race a factor that contributes to that? And then what other sectionalities contribute to how women might be discriminated against within a said organization, within as well as externally? And what the research found is that actually women that are most highly discriminated against are women of color, who identify as Muslim from a religious perspective, especially those that wear hijabs as a signifier or as part of their religious practice. And the reason for this is because there's the demographic indicator of one's difference, i.e. race, the gender as well, and then age sometimes, because ageism is something that we see in the workplace. However, that conflated or in that, in addition to being Muslim, meant that the distance between themselves as well as the person discriminating becomes enhanced because of the symbolism of what certain people take the hijab to mean. So what this actually does is it actually disassociates one from economic activity over and above, the gender, in addition to these other multiple layers of their identity. And for me, when looking at that, it was the question of, okay, how can one actually solve for this? And from a basic perspective, these women are not living in silos, right? And women who have or live an identity of intersectionality do not live in silos. So one, it's allyship, making sure that the bystander effect is not something that works to their disadvantage, but also taking things like race and class and removing them by adding technology. How do I mean, or what do I mean by this? For example, the use of digital platforms for have really worked really significantly in including youth in urban areas, but also enabling individuals to tap into an identityless platform where you can actually just be an individual using the platform for its benefits, not necessarily being seen for all the biases that might come from your race or your class, but also using tech as a way in which we can adapt the access that one has to these financial systems, then takes away the lack that might come from various ableism that is factored into, for example, your physical spaces and places of work. Also, going on a platform enables individuals to access information in ways that is not previously one that might have been of ease. But also, there's the opportunity to take care and make sure that those apps are neuro-inclusive. So yes, the physical ability is something that then gets factored in, or disability gets factored in. But then there's also the neuro-inclusivity. How do we make sure that people with dyslexia, how do we make sure that people with ADHD or even colorblind people are able to use this technology to their advantage? And then there's age. Young people in Africa are in the majority, as well as women. So if you're youth, a woman, as well as a person of color, you are in the majority. And the question here is, how can we make our processes as well as our offerings be future fit, but also take away ageism? Because I've seen models where children as young as 13 are being given a mock-up business like an Airbnb and being asked to run it cradle to grave, from identifying the property, purchasing it, executing on the business model, taking care of tenants, and then evaluating the profitability or loss thereof. And they then grow with an entrepreneurial mindset. How can we ingrain entrepreneurship in our youth? How can we ingrain the use of technology in our lower education or primary education? And how can we actually make our young people future fit, so that they can actually be ready for the work, be a ready workforce of the future? Because in China, they're doing it. We had an immersion recently where we took students to China, Malaysia, and Kenya. And when they compared the three, they said, you know what, we've noticed China is eons ahead when it comes to their curriculum development, because children as young as 7 are already being taught how to code. Imagine when they get to university with someone from South Africa, how will they fare? And will the playing field be level? I certainly think not. So I do think that we need to find innovative ways that we can incorporate the use of technology early stages, notwithstanding our economic challenges. But I think we can start thinking out of the box with regard to how we raise our children so that they future fit.
And finally, let's talk about leadership and leadership models and the decision-making structures that you find in organizations. How are they responding to these challenges? And are they aware of the potential in the organization of opening up opportunities to empower women as co-creators of systemic change?
I think it's a yes and no. I've had conversations with the governor of the Reserve Bank, Ntateli Secha, and he is very pro-women at all levels of the Reserve Bank. You look at the leadership, you look at the deputy governors, and you can see that women are represented as well as in the ManCo. So I do think that there are a lot of male-led organizations that are setting an example for what inclusion looks like. And that, for me, is something that gives hope that it is already an existent model that has proven to work. So the question is, how can we take those pockets of excellence and spread them across the country, the continent, and the world at large? And when I was just contemplating or thinking about this, I thought, you know, distributed decision making is one way that this could potentially enable that, because long gone are these hierarchical organizations where one person is seen to have all the answers. A dialogic approach to leadership that says, you know what, as we enter a space, we all bring value and we also present some of the blind spots that you spoke about in your first question. And the question is, what are the blind spots we're not seeing because we are currently having a tunnel vision or a siloed approach, which is where divergence or diversity then comes in, because it says, you know what, we see things from different perspectives and our nodes of intersectionality come from different perspectives. So we can actually distribute the decision making so that we've got different perspectives of how it is people see this decision, and we can mitigate for risk from different perspectives. And then the second thing is proximity to power is really important. You know, the closer you are to the CEO, to the ESCO, the quicker you can respond to certain things. Hence, earlier on, I spoke about the importance of diversified feedback channels. It's really important for those in leadership to be accessible, and not just physically, you know, coming to my office anytime. It's one thing to come into your office, but it's another for you to listen, and then yet another for you to put into effect some of the recommendations that have been put forward to you. So the question is, how do you create proximity to power? You know, before I would highly recommend CEOs do walking around the floors, do time in motion studies so that their fingertips are right at the pulse of the organization. But now we've got hybrid organizations, we've got individuals that don't go into the office for over a month. And the question is, are town halls enough? Are your performance appraisals every quarter or every 6 months enough? How is a leader, you know, checking the pulse of their people, not just based on what EXCO says or the board? How do you actually go and get to talk to those people that are frontline workers to understand what the customer needs, what services need to improve, but also what is and may not be working within the organization and where the organization is working? So I would recommend that leaders think about how can they actually minimize the power distance between themselves and those that they work with or employ. And then metrics matter, right? What we don't count, we can't necessarily grow, develop, as well as improve. So how do we make sure that the matrices that we use to evaluate the value that individuals bring, the value that, you know, using a collectivized approach to including individuals in decision makings, but also measuring how the organization improves the more diverse it is really important. And that's why an organization that develops systems and processes like dashboards that enable from your procurement to your recruitment to be automated, divergence sensitized, you know, succeed better than leaning on the bias of an individual or the bias of a panel on a certain day, you know. So how can we also take away the human error and the human biases that, you know, behavioral science has shown us to have, and maybe ensure that we nudge people towards a behavior that is inclusive in nature. We also measure things that actually matter, and we make sure that we don't just copy and paste what it is that, you know, top down predetermined matrices are for success, but we actually do bottom up, left to right evaluations of what matters to our organization, what's relevant in this moment in time, but also what do we need so that we can be future fit. So these are some of the ways in which I believe leaders can actually make a shift through the distributed decision making, ensuring that there's proximity to power, and then also making sure that we measure the things that matter by making our matrix one that is relevant, but also agile and responsive to where the organization is, who is within the organization, and where the organization needs to actually go to next.
Well, I think that's a stark message there for leaders. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, Dr. Dangazele, for your time.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to your listeners for listening to this point of the engagement.